So you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. So this is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and I'm happy to welcome you, as we always do on Tuesday at 5 o'clock, to Office Hour. Before I begin, I want to remind you that the views that are expressed in the show may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So as we always do, here we are, 2 o'clock. It's great. 5 o'clock on Tuesday. We're going to knock. Here we go. Knocking on doors. We find out, what are all these faculty members, these students, what are they doing? We're going to take you inside a building today, inside someone's office, and find out what they're thinking about and what they're studying. I'm very pleased today we're going to go into the world of music, and we're knocking on the door of Carol Hess from the Department of Music. So, Carol, I want to welcome you to Office Hour.
Thank you so much, Naomi, for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Okay. And Carol studies Aaron Copland. I mean, a lot of other things, but in particular today we're going to be talking about her research on Aaron Copland. And as an ambassador to South America, and all kinds of issues about his involvement in the Good Neighbor Program. But as always, before we begin the particular research that the guest carries out, we always ask them our first question, which is, how does someone become interested in becoming a musicologist, and in particular the kind of interest you have in Copland and South American music? Were you particularly musical when you were young? Did you play an instrument, or how did you find your way to being a professor of musicology?
Well, I was fortunate to grow up in a musical family and also to be old enough to remember when a strong public school music system was the norm. So I started playing the piano. I started playing the violin. My three sisters and I all loved to sing, as did my parents. So it was a rather noisy household, but a very pleasant one. And music was something that you just did naturally. So from that point, I decided I would major in music. And because I had most of my training in piano, and I wasn't that good of a violinist, I gave up the violin as quickly as I could, although I'm very glad to have had the experience, but concentrated on the piano. That was the major that I had as a undergraduate student. I became smitten, however, with writing and scholarship during that time. But I graduated in the late 70s, and when I approached my music history teacher and said, you know, I'd really like to be a musicologist, he said, I don't think so. You won't get a job. This was the first steep decline in academic hires since the post-war, you know, when so many people were being hired in the 50s and 60s. Suddenly in the late 70s, it started to slide. So like a good student, I continued playing the piano. I then moved to California and set myself up as a private piano teacher. I gave a lot of recitals. I was very busy as a teacher and decided to keep studying and took more degrees in piano. But I realized that all along I really did love music and scholarship, and that if I wanted to get a degree in musicology and prepare myself to be a university professor, I had better act fast so that with luck I could be hired before I reached the exalted age of 40. So I was actually the first PhD in musicology at UC Davis. They had started the department not too long before I showed up. And it was a wonderful place then, as it is now, and I feel very happy to have had that experience. At the same time, I was also learning Spanish. I had a lot of Spanish-speaking friends, and I realized that Spanish music, music from European music, had not been terribly well covered in certain areas. There was a good deal of scholarship on music of the Renaissance. There was a good deal of scholarship in medieval music, but more recent music, there wasn't so much interesting scholarship on that. So I thought, well, this is something that I can do, because I was learning Spanish and was traveling in Spain and enjoying myself very much. So I published my first book on a Spanish composer. And of course, I sent a copy of the book to that professor. And I wrote on the inside, I didn't follow your advice.
I was going to ask you about that. Looking back now at his statement to you, what do you think? I mean, do you think that was a reasonable thing for him to say? I mean, I'm told now that we are supposed to slightly be a little bit discouraging because that we shouldn't hold up too rosy a picture for students, so that you have to tell them that it's very, very difficult, because we know there are fields in which the PhDs are having a hard time finding a job.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, you certainly have disproven his statement. So,
well, and I think it was easier then, certainly, mm-hmm. than it is now, than it has been, say, after 2008. I think he had my best interests at heart. We always got along very well. And I think he was being straight with me. And mm-hmm. he said, you know, if had I said, listen, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, I'm sure he would have supported me and given me a good letter. Maybe it was my timidity to do something that wasn't quite what he initially recommended that made me stay with the piano for many years, which I'm glad that I did. I now teach, and I often look out on the classroom. And if you have, say, 150 students in the Pitzer Recital Hall, and maybe they're looking a little drowsy, you know, I can sit down at the piano and bang out something and then go put on a slide and then put on a recording and, you know, do the dog and pony show. And playing the piano has, I think, helped me do that.
Mm-hmm. Playing a piano is a very sociable skill.
Yes.
I would say that it certainly is. I'm also just wanted to talk briefly, go back to your fraught encounter with the violin.
and the viola.
And the viola. Mm-hmm. Because I remember finding shocking statistics when I started one of my sons on the violin, mm-hmm. that 99.9% of the people who take up the violin, of children who take it up, end up saying, like my son, shaking and saying, oh, you devil, because there's something about violins as just being incredibly difficult instruments. So would you agree on that? Or, I mean, in terms of your move to the piano and finding that so much more welcoming?
Well, I think it all depends on the teacher. I was very lucky to have a very fine violin teacher, and he was also the director of the orchestra program at the public school system that I attended. So he directed the orchestra in the elementary school, in the junior high school, and in the high school. And it was a privilege to work with him. He had a son who was extremely talented, who went to Juilliard and is now a distinguished conductor and has conducted various orchestras throughout mm-hmm. the country. So I learned a lot from him. I think I may have been lazy. You know, with the piano, you can just sit down and start playing.
Yes.
Sort of like what I do in my classes.
Yes.
With the violin, you're tuning, you're putting rosin on the bow, and you have to be in this unnatural position.
Yes.
My left elbow always wanted to float away, and sometimes my teacher would take a string and, you know, tie it so that it would be in the proper position.
Oh, dear.
So I enjoyed it, and I like now the fact that when I occasionally play chamber music, I can listen very attentively to the string players. I also played viola, but that situation with me, you know, there are people who were born to be violists, and there are people who are asked to play the viola because they're musical, and the school orchestra needs a viola. So, oh, here, Carol, why don't you do this? The same way that many girls who really have a soprano voice are asked to sing alto, mm-hmm. because it requires singing something other than the melody.
Mm-hmm.
So in all, it was good, and I'm glad that I had those experiences, and perhaps had I been more mature, I would have stayed with the violin
longer. I think you're being hard on yourself, because I think that a lot of people are quite mature and still can't find themselves mm-hmm. able to conquer playing the violin. But anyway, that's a very interesting story, and I'm glad you found your way to the piano. I also mm-hmm. play piano, and it's tremendously rewarding. So
yes.
It's fun just to be able to sit down and make music. So if we turn now to the figure we want to talk about the most today, that's Aaron Copland.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that many of our listeners have some familiarity with Copland and his music, simply because he's so he's quite one of the sort of big hits of classical music, and is sort of also a crossover figure. I think some of the things that interest me is him as representing what we would think of as American music.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain kind of way, he's considered to be super American.
Right.
And when I was reading about him, I was very struck that, for example, in Ronald Reagan's, some of his advertisements on television, they played Aaron Copland mm-hmm. as being sort of the archetypical American music to play when you're advertising voting for Ronald Reagan, as if people didn't realize that he actually was very leftist when he was alive. So how he became a symbol of America is an interesting question for someone who was born Jewish, like Gershwin, into mm-hmm. In Brooklyn, into a very sort of Russian-derived, European-derived Jewish family, mm-hmm. was quite left-wing, and also very influenced by European composition. He studied in Europe, mm-hmm. but yet somehow he becomes archetypical of American music. Can you tell us a little bit of how you think that happens?
I'll try. A lot of scholars have tackled that question, including my colleague Beth Levy, who wrote a very interesting book about music and representations of the American West. Mm-hmm. Copland may be known for that so-called Americana style, you know, with wide open intervals and rather conventional but colorful orchestrations, and of course the presence of either folk tunes or folk-like right. melodies. But he was actually more eclectic than that, and in fact he was often criticized for being too eclectic, for not really attaching himself to one style or another. At least this was the case in his early career. He studied in France with a very important teacher, Nadia Boulanger, who taught a great many composers from the Americas, not just from the United States. And she instilled certain values, certain disciplines having to do with the European tradition, but at the same time, she encouraged her students from other parts of the world to develop their own voices. And so he was always very grateful for that. And when he comes back to the United States in 1924 and hangs out in New York, he's mixing with all of these avant-garde composers who are basically trying to put music of the United States on the map. And when we talk later about Pan-Americanism, I'll give you the Latin American take on that as well. So he starts out as a avant-garde composer. At the same time, he was also experimenting a little bit with jazz. He wrote a work called Music for the Theater right. and also a jazz-based piano concerto, which he actually played in Santiago, Chile. We can talk about that later if you like, because the reaction to that was at least interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But then he decided that his fellow composers, the crowd in which he moved, was just a bit too
frumpy.
I don't want to say hoity-toity, but they were trying all these advanced techniques and failing to reach out to the ordinary listener.
Yes.
The listener who
the
perhaps...
The common man.
Right. The listener who perhaps did not have, you know, decades of musical education and maybe wouldn't appreciate certain modernist strategies. And he decided to say things as simply as he could. That's a quotation. It's not his exact words, but it's gives the sense of what he was after. And he said, it doesn't make sense to pretend that the listener isn't there. It doesn't make sense for our art, because people who don't care for avant-garde music but like classical music will continue to go to more or less conventional symphony concerts where they'll listen to Beethoven and Brahms, and we don't want that either. Mm-hmm. So let's make an effort.
Find something new.
Right. And so he did have some followers in that. And that is certainly the style that he is most associated with. You mentioned also his leftist tendencies. He was associated for a while with a group called the Composers Collective. And at one point he wrote a what was called a workers chorus. And that unfortunately followed him into the 1940s and 50s. But that was, I think, part of his understanding that, yes, you have to think of your listener. You have to try to say something beyond the somewhat narrow world of avant-garde music. At the same time, he didn't disparage the avant-garde, and he was interested in all sorts of music.
Mm-hmm.
Then, after he had to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the early 1950s, because of association in groups like the Composers Collective. He was also on a committee that raised funds for the Spanish Republic during the Spanish Civil War. He actually auctioned some of his manuscripts, and he made a couple of speeches that were not seen too favorably by Senator McCarthy and his henchmen. The idea that one scholar in particular has advanced is that after that experience, then he started writing 12-tone music. In other words, going back to a very esoteric style that maybe he would have disparaged back in the late 30s, but that now he sees as the way of the future. And in addition, it was one way to distance himself from this idea that you have to address the people, that you have to be concerned with the ordinary person.
So before we leave the common person, we're going to get him into the common person. So so what makes him American would be, we might look at some of those themes there. One would be folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly something he's associated with. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a little bit puzzling to me because you think of European composers who feel more European because they use folk music. So the question is really whether there's anything particularly American about using folk music, in that way. And also he was, as you said, he was very influenced the way in which he took European ideas about composition and also use those as well. So are we kind of kidding ourselves then that the people who put this Ronald Reagan picked this as American music? You mentioned open chords and sort of accessible music as opposed to something very avant-garde and esoteric that people wouldn't understand. So maybe that is the most important thing the other possibility is simply, I'm going to throw this out, that it became American because of familiarity.
And because of the way it was received by its audience.
Exactly. Uh-huh. In other words, that it retroactively becomes American because Americans play it and listen to it a lot.
Exactly. And it does, some of the folk tunes are identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Simple Gifts, the Shaker hymn, is identifiably from the United States, from a certain tradition. Themes, a ballet, for example, a ballet such as Billy the Kid,
mm-hmm.
a ballet such as Appalachian Spring, those are explicitly of the United States in terms of story, but also in terms of musical materials. Many composers, and this happens with Latin American, or composers who wrote about Latin American music, will try to make the case that jazz, that rhythm, is the basis of music of the Americas, which distinguishes it from Europe.
There is
a lot of ink spilled over these matters of musical identity,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
people in the musicological committee, community, people in the arts community, listeners who simply like music but don't quite know why there has to be so much written about it all the time. It's to give people like me a job, right?
Right. Well, I do think your point about narrative is very important, mm-hmm. and that the stories that he told mm-hmm. were American stories, mm-hmm. the example being Billy the Kid. And maybe one of the other reasons why we sort of think of this as American is because we want to think of these things as American stories. So there's something that's a wish in it, even if it isn't really possible to differentiate in that way. And the wish being that something like Billy the Kid, where we, as you said, we have a story about the West, the possibility, we have an openness, we have people, even if there's tragedy in it, mm-hmm. we have the common man reaching out, so that there's something that's very, very hopeful and individualistic, frontier mm-hmm. and all of that then becomes associated with music. And maybe that is more important than certain things about how the composition is actually made.
I think that's correct. The phrase horizon of expectation, if I can sound academic for a moment, comes to mind, that there's a certain level of what audiences expect and that we should take that into account when we are looking at how we regard a particular work of art, whether it's a novel, a film, a work of poetry, or a piece of music. What are audiences thinking about at this point? What is occupying their minds? Also, in Copland's case, sometimes it was simply a matter of timing. When Martha Graham commissioned Appalachian Spring, the ballet, the United States had already entered World War II. Well, what could be a better symbol for U.S. solidarity mm-hmm. than this tale of this young couple starting their life together and being helped by their community?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very inspiring story, and Copland hit it right.
Right. Well, his story in that way is also an American story, immigrant family, mm-hmm. and then he becomes a beloved composer in the country. Though I would be curious if you could say a little bit about how he was viewed. I was quite struck when I was reading about him, how he was denounced at different times by different people, one mm-hmm. of them being some of the other composers, contemporary composers, when he was mm-hmm. first coming on the scene. My favorite one was that he was called part of the filthy bunch of Juilliard Jews
mm-hmm.
by Carl Ruggles, which, I think it's very important for us to mention to listeners that this was a guy who was reviled by other composers mm-hmm. at parts, even mm-hmm. though we think of him as being sort of the easygoing, everybody loved composer.
Right. And Ruggles wasn't the only one. And I think if you ask the proverbial person on the street, if you're walking around downtown Davis and say, which composer have you heard of, Copland or Ruggles? you know, Copeland will win by a wide margin. Mm-hmm. So yes, another person who criticized him was Virgil Thompson, who had also studied with Nadia Boulanger in France. And I think Thompson saw himself as more super cosmopolitan. The two of them got along. They were friends. And Copeland had to his credit that he was always very, very correct and very, very, I shouldn't say always, because I don't know his every interaction with other human beings. Mm-hmm. But he was extremely correct and extremely well-mannered. And if maybe he was behaving that way because it was a good move professionally or because he was genuinely sincere, perhaps, we don't know. But when Thompson wrote an article about Copeland and his eclecticism, this tendency to try this and try that and not seem as if he had an authentic voice, not seem as if he were really willing to throw himself into any one style in particular, Copeland thanked him for the article. Now, this article appeared in 1932, and that's the same year that Copeland begins El Salón México, which was one of his calling cards for Latin America. So that's also the beginning of his interest in writing as simply as possible. So at that point, he actually was finding that voice, which is probably the most enduring of the many voices that Copeland has.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when did Copeland really begin to become famous? In that, when did people really begin to play his pieces widely?
I think it would be that's a good question. I can't give you an exact date. But by the time he was invited to go to Latin America, his first official trip there took place in 1941. I wouldn't say he was super famous, although he had enjoyed many successes. And he also made a name for himself through his articles. Mm-hmm. At one point, he thought of being a writer on music. And he just kept composing, and he kept getting prestigious performances. But as anybody in the arts would know, you know, yes, maybe Koussevitzky plays the eminent composer, conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Maybe Koussevitzky performs some of your music, but, you know, then you still have to eat. You still have to.
Right. You have to wait maybe another year, another 2 years before somebody else plays another one of your famous pieces.
But little by little, he was gaining celebrity thanks to festivals, organizations that he started. He had the advantage also of being very community-minded. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he played an important role in certain organizations that were set up to help young composers, of which he was then not as young as some of the individuals he was helping, but trying to get a forum for his music. Contemporary music.
So by the mid-40s, he had sort of gotten that.
Yes, and I would say even before then.
Even before that.
Right.
I was quite struck by something which I think is shocking for us in the world we live in today in the arts, how much federal support there was for the arts at certain times in his life. He was a man who benefited mm-hmm. from that and was involved in that. So I think we just want to say out loud on our show today that the WPA, which we've all heard about and vaguely remember that this mm-hmm. idea of supporting the arts, they had $4.9 billion that was given in art spending, mm-hmm. and that was not in 2019 dollars.
Right.
So I think it's worth us pausing for a moment and just thinking about that context in which he was becoming famous, was mm-hmm. a context in which the government was really just, arts was just spreading all through parts of the American society that it hadn't been before. Mm-hmm. Because there was just simply people who would pay for people to be trained and to sing and all of those issues.
Yes, the government thought it would make for a better society. And ultimately, they thought it would make for a better world if there were exchange among different nations of their artistic accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. So that, and part of that huge amount of money being spent for art was then going to be his the Good Neighbor program.
Correct.
Which then he was involved mm-hmm. in. So the Good Neighbor, he then tries to build relationships with South America and with conductors and composers in South America. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about the program, because none of us have, I don't think that that's a program that's gone by the wayside, except maybe only hear about Good Neighbors on something like,
Sesame Street.
Exactly.
Sure. The Good Neighbor policy didn't just start. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. After the First World War, it seemed that Europe was exhausted. Mm. I'm speaking now from people who viewed these things from a musical or cultural standpoint, say the standpoint of classical music, whereas European composers had always served as something of a model for the United States.
Yes.
Well, that didn't go so well. In the 1920s, both England and France established, after the war, established government-sponsored cultural diplomacy. Mm-hmm. The British Council, for example, is, it's active throughout the world. But in the United States, anything resembling exchange of culture was always in private hands. And there were some very important private foundations. There was the various Carnegie organizations, the Guggenheim Foundation, which started in the early 1920s. And then in 1929, I believe, they initiated a Latin American program. Mm-hmm. Because among artists and intellectuals, there was this idea that Europe was exhausted and we have to look to our own hemisphere. And there were many artists and intellectuals who were critical of the United States and their approach to these things. And they really thought that they could learn something from Latin America.
So this was a general kind of feeling among different parts of the arts community.
Yes, I think in the arts community. Now, politics told a different story. Because, as you know, the United States has a long history of interventionism at that time, especially in Central America.
Right.
But previously in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so these two ideas are more or less at odds with one another. But then there's the Great Depression. Roosevelt is elected. And just before 6 weeks before Roosevelt gives his inauguration speech in 1933, Hitler is in power in Germany. And so people who were paying attention, people who were conscious of world politics, began to put all of these things together. Now, this is Roosevelt's famous speech in which he refers to fear itself. Mm. And of course, his main concern was to give the citizens of the country some hope that the Depression would not completely ruin them. But of course, he was also talking about the possibility of a war with Europe. Just as an aside in that speech, he mentioned this concept of a good neighbor. The good neighbor is someone who respects himself, to use the pronoun of the day, and also his neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. Then little by little, he starts talking more about the good neighbor, the concept of the good neighbor. Shortly thereafter, his Secretary of State goes to Montevideo to a Inter-American Conference and says, okay, we're not going to intervene in your governments any longer. Mm. And the Latin Americans
are... All we're going to do is play music with you.
Latin Americans are, whoo, that's cool. And then Roosevelt himself goes to Buenos Aires in 1936, and people are coming out of the streets and cheering. There was still the question of whether cultural diplomacy should be in the hands of the government or whether it should be in private hands, and in part because of Roosevelt's own popularity and the fact that he had, other programs got pushed through. The Division of Cultural Relations was established in 1938, so that when the United States went to, ultimately went to war, there was plenty of advance work done for the idea that uniting the hemisphere would be a good idea. What if European markets dried up? What if there were Nazi infiltration in the hemisphere, which there was?
There was. So you have to make sure that everybody in South America is going to be politically aligned with America.
Yes.
With the United States. Mm-hmm. So you do that through culture.
Through soft power.
That's right. And cultural exchanges is the way to make sure we are good neighbors, and that will make them good neighbors to us, right?
That was the idea. And there were economic incentives as well. Right. And of course, the idea of not intervening was very attractive. And it wasn't uniformly followed either, but it was still the gist of the thing. And the fact that Roosevelt, unlike so many presidents from the United States, showed extreme respect for Latin Americans and was willing to mount this program, mm-hmm. so that the Americas could talk to one another.
Right. And so Copeland gets involved in this program. Now, we've come to the end of the first half of the show. So what we're going to do is we'll take a break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about what happens when Copeland goes to South America. And we've not only queried whether there's something called American music, now we're going to have an even more complicated question, whether there's something called Pan-American music, right, that Copeland then shared with his composer colleagues from the South. So stay with us, and we'll come back to the second half of Office Hour just a bit. So, welcome back to Office Hour. This is part two for today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're talking with Carol Hess from the music department today about Aaron Copland and the many adventures he had in his life. Now he is about to fly off to South America because he's being sent by the United States government, which in this period was interested in the 30s, was interested in being a good neighbor and also in encouraging South American countries to be good neighbors and join America in the war effort if they ended up going to war against the Nazis. So it's from what I read about Copland, he seemed to have quite enjoyed going on these trips and have made many friends and really have more even than maybe the program was designed to do, really, to have incorporated South American themes into his music and made lasting friendships with composers. So it seemed like it was quite a successful use of American soft power, as you say.
He succeeded in many ways, and he certainly did have a lot of friends in Latin America. He had gotten to know the Mexican composer Carlos Chavez back in the 20s when Chavez came through New York. He visited the United States frequently, and Copland wrote a very strongly worded essay about Chavez's music and how this was the hope of music of the New World. And although we were just saying that Copland was trained by a very eminent European teacher, Nadia Boulanger, and certainly he respected European composers, there were moments where he thought Europe was just too much. At one point, he writes to Chavez, I think it was in 1931, and he says, "Carlos, I'm sick of Europe."
Yes. Yes, I saw that. You were talking about the idea, which is quite interesting, that Americans at that point in the arts community thought that Europe had kind of gotten repetitious, old hat, and no longer was the forefront of anything, and that that's why American artists had to look someplace else.
Right, right. So then Copland gets interested in Mexico. Many people were at that time. I'm talking now about the early 30s, when Mexico was a bit of a beacon for lefty types, for I guess what several decades ago would have been called hippies. I'm not saying that Copland was a hippie, but by going to Mexico and presumably imbibing this pure and fresh, natural, let's say, environment. This was also in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution, and so the idea that Mexico is on the right track politically is also very much in the air. And in the United States, ravaged by the Depression, and at a point when left-leaning politics is as strong as it's ever been, as best I can tell, this is all very attractive. And for Copland, again, it's a question of timing. He is often in the right place at the right time. Carlos Chavez conducts some of his music. The first all Copland concert to be given anywhere was given in Mexico City in 1932.
Okay, that's a pretty interesting idea. Yeah. It's a pretty interesting statistic right there, a fact there. That So there was a great deal of interest in Copland there, maybe even more so than in America at the same time.
That might be hard to say, but certainly it's interesting to point out these things that happened there but didn't happen in the United States. Mm. Copland wrote in his modernist period a piece called A Short Symphony, and Chavez had that performed. Chavez performed it before it was performed in the United States. Hmm. And this was one of those works of Copland's that was not an audience pleaser. So either the Mexican audience was ready for this or Chavez simply wanted to do it. In any event, Copland was very grateful. Now, this is all in the 30s. And as I said before the break, the Division of Cultural Relations is established in 1938. And all the while, the threat of a possible war with Europe is looking worse and worse. And various visitors in South America come back and they have all these stories about Nazi infiltration. Mm. Argentina was especially targeted, but there were also large German populations in Brazil. There's the state of Santa Catarina, where you can go and see what look like chalets, you know, or architecture that is very much in the style of the country that these German immigrants left behind. Also some strong Italian populations as well, especially in Argentina. So visitors come back and they say, you know, things are looking bad. And not only that, but Italy and Germany are pursuing cultural diplomacy. They're inviting, this Brazilian composer, Francisco Mignone, is invited to Berlin, and he gets to conduct.
So there was some of it was competition. In other words, mm-hmm. that it was really that the American government also didn't want to be the only people on the block that weren't sending composers, the only people in the country in the world that wasn't sending composers to South America.
Composers, architects, writers, dancers. Mm-hmm. There was one very splashy, and it was an expensive project. It was the American Ballet Caravan, which went throughout South America giving performances. So they were trying to cover as many different bases as possible. There were also government officials who would simply go and talk about good government and things like this. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you're quite right. The United States didn't want to be left behind in all of this, but I think they also genuinely believed that cultural diplomacy was one more weapon, if you will, in the war, the possible war, mm-hmm. Which, as we know, came to pass.
So, musically, then, what do you think? Did Copland see this separate from the war effort? Did he really see this as he believed in a form then of pan-America music? That because they liked to play his music and he was influenced by that, that this was something that was quite real to him. And it wasn't just that he was going there for political reasons, but that he actually believed there was a kind of a musical solidarity between the different American cultures from the South and the North, and that was actually important.
I think he certainly believed that in his first trip in 1940, and then later in his second trip, as I say, he made additional trips as a private citizen, but these were two trips that he made in 1941 and 1947 under the auspices of the State Department. And I think he certainly believed those things at that time. Part of it was this interest in rhythm that, again, it would be tedious for your listeners, I think, for me to go into all the ins and outs of these rather arcane and not very solid comments about so-called American rhythm, and I mean America writ large, you know, of the Americas, mm-hmm. the American continent, if you will. He believed that that was a uniting factor in music of the hemisphere. There were also this use of folk materials, indigenous materials. Copland believed that in the United States that the indigenous peoples did not leave a sufficiently interesting musical repertory for us to work for U.S. composers to work with, but he did not feel that way about South America or Latin America, I should say. That was one of the things he most admired about Chavez's music. Now, a lot of these critics, composers, whoever, go and listen to a piece of music and they react to it emotionally. They want to like it, so then they suddenly have to come up with all these reasons that justify their judgment. Mm-hmm. And with Copland, it was very easy to make this Pan-Americanist argument because it was in the media, it was in the government, it was very popular in the United States, in part because of Roosevelt's popularity.
Uh-huh. But I want to go back to that point mm-hmm. briefly, because I think it's very interesting that what characterizes Pan-Americanism then for him was in part the idea of rhythm. And you had mentioned before that also characterizing American, but in that case you had mentioned jazz briefly. Mm-hmm. It's hard for you to imagine that jazz was a South American notion. So when without being too mm-hmm. technical, just to help our listeners understand this a little bit, what do they mean by rhythm when you say that? Can you give us an idea? Are we talking about syncopation? Primarily?
Well, it could be syncopation. It could be a certain level of complexity. Uh-huh. Copland wrote a fair amount, and don't forget, this is in a period of, you know, Copland was a victim of anti-Semitism, but of course, this is also a period of extreme racism.
Yes,
North and South.
Absolutely.
And so, if Copland or any other composer writes a jazz-based piece, there will likely be some repercussions of. Likely some reaction on the part of some critics, you know, why? What are you doing writing black music or Negro music, as it was called? Most critics would not be quite so blatant about it, but I'm thinking of one Boston critic who said something relatively, you know, somewhat along those lines.
Uh-huh.
So with Latin American music, I'm thinking, say, of the Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos, the Afro-Brazilian rituals, the Afro-Brazilian instruments were certainly of interest to Copeland, and he absorbed these, and he felt that this was the real Latin America in terms of music.
Well, maybe that actually permitted them to expropriate certain things about things that you might call jazz without saying they're taking jazz. You know, maybe it permitted them to sort of have a subterfuge about how they were, what they were taking and developing. So it permits them to sort of have their cake and eat it too.
They meaning U.S. composers.
Yes. In other words, the composers, they're able to make use of rhythms that you might have characterized in a certain kind of way, but saying, but we're not doing it. We're not doing that kind of music. It just sounds like it because we're doing that. And I know you have written also on the Walt, and I was thinking about now the Walt Disney movie, Saludos Amigos, which was 1947, was
42.
It? 42. 42. Thank you. Right. 1942. So I guess that many of our listeners have probably not listened to it, but you can find it very easily. And it's a good thing to listen to after you've heard the show, because there you see the same thing, that Walt Disney is trying to be a good neighbor. Mm-hmm. So it makes this film about going down to South America and all the music that's down there. And it presents it through characters. And it says we can learn something from these cultures. And it literally shows the Walt Disney people who are going to be the cartoonists going down there and learning about the culture and drawing cartoons. And then it tells you these stories. And I was quite struck because about the rhythm as being one of the things that characterizes that film in a way as well, that there's a lot of that emphasis on a highly rhythmic samba over and over again. And that's part of, I think, the entertainment, the Walt Disney sort of value of that.
Yes. And don't forget, this is also at a point where, well, since the 20s, that Latin American ballroom dances have been extremely popular in the United States. The tango, the rumba, or rumba spelled with an H in the American spelling. And so there's a great deal of popularity here, as well as Hollywood movies, which, for lack of a better term, I just call good neighbor movies or Pan-American themed movies. Carmen Miranda, Xavier Cugat. Now, ask Latin Americans what they think about such movies. And
okay,
they'll
let's
say,
ask it.
Okay. Of course, I can speak for all Latin Americans, right? I'm always very careful about saying that, you know, I'm La Gringa del Norte and I don't want to impose my opinions. But it shouldn't come as any big surprise that when Hollywood makes movies in which Spanish speakers are portrayed as slow-witted, or there are mistakes in spelling or in geography, or as well as many musical mistakes. For example, there's a movie, I think it's from 1942, called Down Argentine Way. Well, there isn't a single tango in it, but there are some African-Americans doing a dance that would probably be more associated with Brazil, although even that is a stretch. Well, Latin Americans are not going to feel particularly comfortable with that. And in fact, I have read about protests in Buenos Aires movie theaters. So this is something that the United States had to clean up. The Division of Cultural Relations had a music committee, but it also had a film and radio committee. And then just before Pearl Harbor, another committee was founded by Nelson Rockefeller, who brought his wealth and the prestige of his social position and succeeded in complicating the cultural diplomacy efforts to some degree. He also had a Hollywood committee in his outfit. And at one point, things got so out of hand that they had to hire a bilingual and bicultural specialist, a gentleman from Cuba, but who had studied in the United States, to say, look, when you show this scene, this is what Latin Americans are going to think. If you show so many of these frothy musicals, Latin Americans are going to think that we in the United States are assuming that these people have nothing better to do than
sing and dance
put a banana on their head. And so with Saludos Amigos, much was made of the fact that the Disney team did their research. Now, in part, much is a little bit like what we were saying earlier. Is it because we are led to believe something, or is it because it's really so? Well, it's true that the team did go there for 4 months.
Yeah.
It's also true that at that time, Disney was having a lot of labor problems, and it was great for him to be able to get away and go under the auspices of this war-related effort and, you know, get points for doing so. One of the cartoonists in Argentina, a gentleman named Molina Campos, who was known for his drawings of gauchos, did not like the end result and insisted on having his name removed, which it was not. They did a certain amount of homework as far as the music. Uh-huh. And again, much was made of this. But in the end, only one Latin American composer
is
used.
By name.
Right. Well, the music is used. Yes. It's the samba that you referred to.
Yeah.
And then in other instances, well, I think people who know indigenous music well, people who know the music of the gauchos well, would be very surprised and not terribly pleased to have a ragtime accompaniment for a triste, which is one of the songs that the gaucho presumably sings alone in the solitude of the pampas.
So it was surprising Disney did not get it exactly correct. But right. I do think it is interesting that the cultural context was to try. You mean, at least there was a lot of mm-hmm. attempt to try mm-hmm. to be a good neighbor.
Right.
When looking back at from your point of view, do you think that Copeland did a better job than Disney? You know, are you willing to come out and say on that?
I think one reason Copeland was a good diplomat, he had many qualifications for the job. He spoke reasonable Spanish, which was unusual in an era when most primary and secondary school students in the United States had Latin or French.
Yes.
German, of course, you didn't do after the First World War. That was out. So he could get along in the language. He was, a very affable person. He was genuinely interested in what was going on. And I guess he had that sort of stamina that you need to go to all those receptions and talk to this diplomat and shake that person's hand. So I think in that sense, he did have success. Now, I think there were times when he should have kept his mouth shut, although in general, he did keep his mouth shut. He confided his negative feelings to his travel diaries, which are in the Library of Congress and which I have read many times. And it was quite clear that he didn't always like what he heard.
Mm-hmm,
he would meet with such and such composer, and that person would show him a whole slew of pieces. And Copeland would say, well, you know, I didn't really hear anything very interesting today. But he did spend the time, and he did make the effort. So the fact that he was able to keep his mouth shut, as I say, most of the time, but not all of the time, suggests that it was a good move on the part of the State Department.
And he was a good neighbor. And
I think in the end he was.
He was a good neighbor.
Right.
Well, that says quite a lot. You also gave me a piece which is an op-ed that you had written, arguing that we need to have more of those kinds of programs. So I'm mm-hmm. curious just for your thoughts about music in the abstract as a form of cultural exchange. And do you think there's something particularly good about music if you want to try to build, like if you suddenly became the consultant for the United States government, as unlikely as
I'm
that
sure
is,
they're on the verge of calling me.
After
right.
the show.
Yes.
What case would you make for, or do you not think it's particularly music and that it's just that all of arts are very good as a way of building relationships, even if there's likely to be misunderstanding, as you saw, or things that don't necessarily click from one ambassador to a different culture?
Well, music is very fluid. We are fond of saying that mathematics is the most abstract of the sciences, if you will, and music the most abstract of the arts. From some people's point of view, music has no meaning other than the relationships between the tones and the timbres and the rhythms and the harmonies. Now, most people really don't listen to music that way, however. They're reminded of something. There is some element of human experience that the music awakens in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're importing music to another country, it might mean very surprising things in a new constituency. There's an episode of Copeland having one of his pieces performed in Peronist Argentina in 1947. Now, Perón was the enemy of the United States. Well, the Argentine audience loved the piece for all the reasons that the State Department did not want it to.
What do you mean?
Well, the piece is called Lincoln Portrait, and it's for speaker, narrator, and orchestra. And when the narrator speaks about different aspects of Abraham Lincoln's personality and his career, the Peronist papers went crazy with enthusiasm because they saw an echo of their own leader in the person of Lincoln. So I don't think the State Department was exactly after that. So my only point is that music is very fluid and it can be appreciated in many different ways. In some ways, it might be a safer call. What speaks more eloquently? Words, a political speech, or a piece of music that people react to on a strong gut level. Mm-hmm. If I had to, you know, wrap things up and ask people to think about something as we, you know, as I can conclude my visit with you here, which has been very, very pleasant, it might be something along those lines. Obviously, the same thing can be said for a work of art, you know, visual arts or film. That's the nature of art. And that's why it's so unfortunate that cultural diplomacy, the funding was cut from the 1990s because it really reached its height during the Cold War. It started in South America. I think a lot of people forget that. But then after the war, it was increased so that the Soviet satellites could receive visitors of jazz mm-hmm. musicians or rock musicians or folk musicians or symphony orchestras. But then after the fall of the Soviet Union, it seemed like it wasn't necessary any longer. And we've seen that that's not the case. The world is still struggling with many things that we wish we had. You'd think we would have learned as a human species, but...
And you'd think, and the idea of the good neighbor. So maybe there's two, I wonder if looking back at these experiences of the 1930s that you've studied and have laid out in such an interesting way for us this afternoon, that one of them is the pragmatic argument, that it does seem that it is helpful for that even, that soft power is a form of power, and that the these connections may have helped political alliances. So one of them is that you could go to somebody, a hard-nosed money cruncher, and you could say it's money well spent to build, because as you're saying here, maybe you know, people have shared emotional experiences around the arts. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the second argument is more, it's just about the arts per se, and it's not so pragmatic. We don't care what we get out of it, but that it's a way of sharing our humanity.
Yes, I think both are, in my view, of course, I'm not exactly unbiased, but in both of those are compelling reasons for taking this on. If you have to persuade somebody that it's a good thing, well, look at surveys that show world favorability opinions about the United States. I haven't looked at such surveys in a scholarly way since... You know, surveys that were taken, say, in the aftermath of 9/11. Now, I don't know what those statistics are reading now. I can't imagine that they would be particularly positive.
Mm-hmm. But if we sent some more music around,
you never know. It hasn't completely died. Hip hop diplomacy in the Middle East is a big thing.
Uh-huh.
A colleague of mine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is very involved in that.
Uh-huh.
And The other pragmatic argument is that it just isn't that expensive.
Right, right. Artists are cheap. Artists are very cheap. So
we're economical.
You're economical. So I want to encourage all our listeners to go and listen to some Aaron Copland. Okay, do you have a particular piece you would tell them to start with first? We'll go out with a little bit of...
Sure. If we're going out on music, we might choose an outdoor overture.
Okay.
Which was performed in Buenos Aires in 1941 and a couple of other cities.
Okay.
When critics listened to it and when they wrote about it, those who were imbued with the Pan-Americanist spirit, because certainly there were some critics who believed the United States was still the great enemy, but they... referred to the youth and vitality of the piece. It was a composition that Copland wrote on commission for the New York High School of Music and Art.
Terrific. Well, then we will go out on the youth and vitality and Americanism, maybe even Pan-Americanism of an outdoor adventure. And I want to thank, outdoor overture. Outdoor overture. I want to thank you for coming on the show. And I want to remind our listeners, you can find this archived on officehourucdpodcast.com. This show will not be archived until tomorrow, but it will be up there. And all of our other shows are archived there. And you can join us then next week. We will come back and knock on somebody else's door. So in the meantime, listen to Copland.